Hello and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms with Padre Greedy and me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about science, rationalism, atheism and the left. Our guests on today's show are the writers Julie Burchill and Sarah Lawrence. Julie Burchill needs little introduction. Her often controversial and polemical writing has been a feature of numerous newspapers and magazines for nearly 30 years. During this time, her colourful private life has generated almost as many column inches. Her novel for teenagers, Sugar Rush, has been made into a successful and now prize-winning series for Channel 4. Sarah Lawrence has worked for The Times and The Mail and is currently working with Julie on a play for the BBC. Her own novel for teenagers will be published later next year. This conversation was recorded earlier this week over numerous glasses of champagne at Julie's house in Brighton, so I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as we enjoyed making it.
So, welcome to Little Atoms. We're here with Julie Burchill, who has described herself as a controversialist of some 30 years standing, and Sarah Lawrence, who has just sold her first novel, Hijinks, to Faber in the UK and Penguin in the US, and is about to make an awful lot of money. So, we rarely do kind of dual interviews, so maybe start off with both of you telling us about your roots into journalism and what provoked you into it almost.
Well, I was a very, I'm Julie, I'm the one with the funny voice, Sarah's like posh. I was a very miserable 16-year-old schoolgirl, dreading to go back and do my A-levels, and there was an advert in the NME in 1976 in the summer, which I read religiously every week, and it wanted a hit-me-hand gunslinger, and it's quite embarrassing. And so I copied, I wrote a review for a Patti Smith album, and I had the typewriter, but because I wanted to look extra young, I wrote it in the school exercise book, which I then tore out raggedly, so I was like really backward. Then I shook a fountain pen over it to make it look blotty, childish. And they thought teenagers were like a figment of their imaginations from like an Eddie Cochran song. So when they knew there was like the 17-year-old girl who could actually write, I think it like, you know, blew their hippie minds a bit. So Bob's your uncle, in 2 months' time, I was like running about with a Clash in a van. So it's like a schoolgirl's dream.
As I've always heard the story, it's been that the enemy was basically full of a bunch of old prog rock hippies who were very, very scared of punk. Is that true?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, they all later got on the bandwagon, but in the early days when Tony and I would put on a Clash record in the review room, they would all do this amazingly asinine thing where they'd pretend to pogo. So they were just like, you saw this bunch of fucking hippies just like smirking off their heads on Wacky Backy.
Tell me your Paul Weller story.
I wouldn't have it. After it's like Wacky Backy, just like pogoing madly, and look, and then, you know, the Clash would come up the office and they'd be all putting their arms around, and that was a bit of sick making. They would wait until, you know, the bandwagon was fully rolling before they all jumped aboard it, which made one feel a bit sick
in the first place. Yeah. So Sarah, how about yourself?
Well, I was a very happy 16-year-old and I've always been a massive show off. I've always loved the papers and loved journalism, and it just seemed a natural thing for me to do. So I turned up at the Times on work experience. Did well, got offered a job, started writing, then commissioning, and then met my dear friend here, Julie.
Sarah was my wrangler. She was the only person at the time who would actually have the nerve to ring up and ask me to write things, as opposed to just have my name on.
Well, I couldn't believe we'd sit there at a conference. They'd all say, "We want you to write things," and they'd say, "Oh, but we can't ask her." And I'd say, "Well, for Christ's sake, we're paying her X amount of money. She's got to do it." So I phoned up, and
first I thought it was outrageous.
The first time I met you, you invited me to come down here and see. She goes, "Come down and see a play all about me."
This was the play Julie Burchill.
Yeah, it's really well. Should have been called that.
Well, that's it. That's a Jeffrey Bernard one, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a way. It was excellent, with Jackie Clune playing me, and that was a brilliant.
It was
thing.
Excellent. We hit it off. We talked all night.
Yeah, we talked all night. And she was the last girl standing. I had about 8 people there, and they all just passed out. I had to kick them into the yard. And she was the only girl that had got up and staggered away at the end of it. We went and got a train and went back to work again.
Yeah, went straight back to work the next day. No sleep.
She's the only girl I know who's got a better constitution than I do.
Well, can we just, we should pause at this minute and say that, a bit of a scoop, last night, although this is going out on Friday, so Monday the 20th, Julie, you won an international Emmy.
Yeah, I'm so excited still, and then I say, I won an Emmy, but then I sort of mumble and go, It's international for young people's program. Because it's an international for young people's program, which does water down the glamour of it a bit. Mm. But I'm still a few steps above special effects, but I think I'm down for makeup. Somewhere in the middle. But I'm still, because I never won an award in 30 years for journalism. Mm. At first, my students would enter me, and then it got embarrassing. It was obvious I was unpopular, I was never going to win. So in 30 years, not to win anything for journalism. And then in quick succession, before this, I won a Stonewall, the Gay Award,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
for Sugar Rush. Mm-hmm. So two in a row for Sugar Rush, none from journalism. I mean, go figure what we have more fun doing.
No, it's
I don't think they like me in journalism.
I think they're all jealous. All the people on the... all those judges.
It's interesting that Sugar Rush, which went out at, 11:30 at night over here,
yeah.
It actually won a...
Children's
one of children's and teenage problems, and
it's a teenage novel.
It's a teenage novel. It's about teenage characters. And do you think maybe it's something in this country that if it's, I mean, I don't know if people have seen Sugar Rush or not. It is about a teenager's lesbian experiences. Do you think that there's something particular in this country that kind of held back from kind of thinking that this could be a show for kids just because it was about gay experiences?
They did smutty it up a lot, I must say, because the book's relatively clean, even though it's got a sticker on the front which says warning, explicit content. Well, I asked my editor at McMillan, and she goes, oh, no, because there's nothing like that in there. And she goes, it's just get the parents off, figure about. I took the publicity.
Yeah.
But when they made it into a TV show, I mean, I was shocked by how frisky it was, is the word frisky is in the
back. Right. And very it was on our Big Brother.
It was, yeah, but yeah. I always wondered if teenagers watching it. But then you go and you see on the talk boards, and lots of them are quite young.
But it's interesting that in children's literature, there have been a number of examples of books that have been, you know, about sex and things. And it's
My Life as a Dog was a big one, I can't remember.
Well, they're all misbehaved, they're all junkies and prostitutes, it's all Melvin Burgess. And
yeah.
But what I was going to say was that doesn't necessarily translate into children's programmes, so there's not a thing after Blue Peter. Sugar Rush wasn't shown after Blue Peter or whatever, was it? You know, it's on it.
I maintain that the way it was in the book, it could have been shown after Blue Peter, but the good fellows at Shine decided to dirty it up for their own wicked ends.
Well, they also made the character older, didn't they, as well?
Yeah, they did. In the book, she's Jesus, I don't think they didn't make character older. The girls who played them, which is why it wasn't dirty, were already 20 years old in the first series, and they're playing, I think, 15-year-olds. No, I don't think they made the character older, but the actresses were.
Okay.
If it had been young actresses, I would have felt bloody bit watching
it. Well, there's something I'd say, not comparing teenage lesbianism to paedophilia, but the same thing happened with getting into very risky ground here. But a similar thing happened with Kubrick's Lolita, didn't it? That Sue Lyon was in, she was 20 or something, and then they also brought the age up from 12 to 15, 16.
I think it's different because if it's two girls mucking about, it's not as sinister, is it? It's just like, ooh, their hands zipped. They're playing hopscotch and they fell over. It's more playful. As I think David Brent says about lesbianism at some point in The Office. When girls do it, it's not as menacing, it's more playful, which I can certainly vouch for.
So the reason that Sarah is here as well today with Julie is that the two of you are writing a play for the BBC.
1 hour drama for the BBC as part of their decade series, which I think is the most ambitious drama series they've ever commissioned. And it takes, they've got 35 writers or writing teams, and everyone takes a year between 1917 and 2005. And you pick a news event and write a drama about that, whichever year you've got. And we've got 1985,
yeah.
Which we're very happy about. Great song.
Rag to You by Brian Adams.
We built this city.
And they're the best ones.
That's the George Michael.
Woo!
Well, we know what to put in for the musical.
so we know what's on the soundtrack, but what's the play actually about?
It's a pro-American play. It's Love Across the Barricades, set in Greenham Common. A love affair between a 19-year-old middle-class English girl called Clemency and a 19-year-old black American Air Force man called Corey.
That's a sex
scene. There's going to be a great sex scene right up against the barbed wire.
That's Scars and Stripes.
It's called Scars and Stripes.
It's also got a bit of magic realism in, but don't hold that against us. Spread thinly.
So it's our contractual obligation then, the magic realism.
No, we just said that all over.
Congratulations.
So it's based on... as I understand, it's based at Green Common, which is one of the great kind of iconic things of the iconic moments of the left in the 80s. I mean, are you critical of them. You say it's a pro-American play.
At the time, I was very sympathetic to the Queen and Common Women, but I was brought up by my dad, who was a fanatical Stalinist. He told me that American history had brains which were one third smaller than Europeans. He was a communist eugenics man. So not that much to be believed, really. But I've had a very long journey towards being pro-American, whereas Sarah, she'll tell you, has seen the light right from the beginning. Went across there and lived in a shack.
Yeah, I did, and I did a master's in American literature and culture, and absolutely fell in love with it. And I just, you know, I think understanding America at the moment is just racism, pure and simple, and stupidity, actually. And if you think about all the music we listen to, all the films we watch, all the stuff, it just seems absolutely alien to me.
Mm. Well, I mean, there's, you know, we could look at the politically America over the last, 30 years, and there are plenty of examples of why you would think that a person who was a progressive would be, think that there was something wrong with that, but that there has become this sort of reflexive anti-Americanism is just something that you need to be part of the left, isn't it?
For stupid people.
So where does that come from?
Where does what come from?
This default kind of as if anti-American is a morally kind of coherent position just to be anti one country.
I think it's a pack mentality.
I think much of it is down to envy. People in England, I've noticed, especially a lot of rather upper middle class, left wing people like Paul Foot. Mm-hmm. Previously, let's face it, they'd been running their own empire, and I think it was this really sort of horror. How do these hicks with hay between their teeth come to rule an empire? That empire is really ours, and I think that's why you get people siding with most fascist third world movements, because they can't stand anybody having an empire but the British.
Yeah.
Even left-wing people can become amazingly left-wing British people who normally are very anti-British can become amazingly pro-British when you talk about Americans. We were at a party once and we were saying about how much we liked America, and this left-wing boy started ranting on about the poverty there, and we said to him, what about the poverty in England? And he just went, there's no poverty in England. And this is somebody...
We got up and walked out.
We walked out. But you'll be aware of stuff like this. Bernard, I can't pronounce his name. Bernard Henry Levy. My dear friend Bernard Henry.
Gorgeous.
As we say in Bristol. He says that anti-Americanism, like anti-Semitism, is a socialism of idiots, which I think is a very, very clever thing to say.
Yeah. Now, recently, myself, I've been reading Christopher Hitchens' Blood, Class and Empire, which examines, and it was written back in when, like, late 80s.
Wow.
Yeah, and it examines very well the relationship between, the so-called special relationship between Britain and the United States. And it kind of reflects the point you're making in that he posits this idea, well, he doesn't posit himself, but it comes up constantly throughout the book, the vague idea of a kind of Greek-Roman relationship between Britain and the United States, where Britain is Greece, where the place where the great ideas originated, but Rome was, in the end, the more powerful. But there's something in that, I think, which there's. Underlying that, there's maybe an idea that America doesn't have the intellectual authority that Britain has. I mean,
go back to basics and say, who are Americans? They are us. They are Europeans. I mean, who landed at Plymouth Rock?
It wasn't Martians.
You know, they didn't just appear out of nowhere.
Mm.
And I think also if you define yourself as anti-American, then what are you then saying that you are for?
Mm. Well, as we've seen, the sleeper reason breeds monsters, and being anti-American now means that you will end up like John Pilger, supporting the most amazingly fucking tyrannical and oppressive people.
We are all Hezbollah now.
I mean, you know, the Nazis came up today, and they was just the other side of beige. You know, people like Chomsky, John Pilger, Martin Blessing, it's still very better than the Nazis. They're only trying to realise, get rid of America. Why should America oppress the Nazis?
Do you think it's a problem with power? That there's an idea that among the European left that anything that's powerful automatically must be opposed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So therefore, just because something's powerful, it immediately is wrong.
Yeah, but they only have that setting for white people. Yeah. If you try and point out that the countries which fund van der Jihad are the most oppressive and filthy rich in the world. If you point out that, like, you know, the royal family in Saudi Arabia have got, like, you know, solid gold, like, fittings in every bathroom, somehow the fact that the Arab countries are tyrannical and much richer than people are in America, and they're like Bill Gates, they never dream of giving, you know, half their freaking fortune away. I'd love to see that. And of course, in lots of the Muslim countries, they still have slavery. Yeah. It's not me making it up. You can look on the Anti-Slavery Society website, and it's only Muslim countries that have slavery. For some reason, this doesn't register with left-wing people. It's like they believe that people who are the other side of beige can literally do nothing wrong. And it's like they decide their politics from a Dulux paint chart. In any given conflict, who's the lighter? They's the wrong ones.
Yeah, yeah. So it's only white people are capable of racism.
Yeah, I know, which is amazingly awful. And in a way, that's a very racist viewpoint, because it implies that non-white people live in a sort of childlike state of innocence, and they can never actually be, like, they can't think of anything evil because their brains aren't up to it.
Yeah.
Obviously, look at Bathurst, you know, look at the fucking Muslim Brotherhood. Nobody believes me when I tell them the Muslim Brotherhood fought with Hitler in the Second World War. And they go, oh, no, no, they're anti-racist. No, they're freaking not!
Well, I mean, the Ba'ath Party explicitly and the Muslim Brotherhood both, you know, it's in the literature, you only have to read it, that they were influenced by the Nazis.
Absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt. And, you know, white people, white different people in this country, I can see myself, I'm very white and I'm very bloody left-wing, more so than these people are, because I want the vote and democracy for everybody, not just white people. And when you do hear anti-war protesters saying, troops out, what exactly do they think coloured people should be allowed to have? If you try to bring in identity cards in this country, it's up in arms, don't take our freedom away. They really believe that white people should be allowed a level of autonomy and choice, but they don't think people in Iraq should be allowed to have it. And that, to me, stuns me. My dad had many things wrong with him. You know, he's a Stalinist and he said bad things about America's brains. But he was completely in favour of democracy and freedom for everybody. And he had left school at 15. I don't see why all these people with expensive educations can't understand that Iraqi wants to vote as much as I do, probably freaking more.
Yeah.
Well, that's a standard internationalist position,
I
which
know
is what
it is,
you would expect
a socialist
to be. Yeah,
but it's so much gone to sleep, hasn't it, in recent years?
Yeah, it's totally disappeared. Well,
sorry, I got a bit carried away. I'm trying to get telling on.
I had a really interesting point there.
Sorry,
well, I think the idea of white people, very interesting, brings up the topic of Israel, in that Israel is kind of semi-seen as part of Europe, and maybe, I mean, do we, not we, I mean, not us assembled this table.
We're just good people here.
But the
there's evil people.
But the left more broadly hold Israel to some completely other standard.
Oh, absolutely.
To its neighbours.
Makes you want to vomit. The hypocrisy of it makes you want to actually puke up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in Israel, they can have all that. They can have their cake and eat it. They can accuse them of everything. They can see them as white. They can see them as Europeans. They can see them as oppressors of people of colour. And let's face it, and the old terrible, disgusting virus of anti-Semitism gets its, you know, it's a respectable people. Mm. Anti-Zionism is the respectful form of anti-Semitism. People tell me that's not so, but I know it is. And when you hear people talking, and they say anti-Zionism, they'll say Israel the first three times, and then eventually the fourth or fifth they'll start saying the Jews. And it's like just one, two, three, the Jews. And you know, I'd like to get these fuckers wired up to a lie detector test, not the one you buy at W.H. Smith, which is not which for parties for children, but a proper police one. And if you questioned 9 out of 10 anti-Zionists, sooner or later they're anti-Zionists too, and no one's going to tell me any of the different.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of times I've been on various internet comments and things, being accused in inverted commas of my favourite was, you're either Jewish or you're shagging a Jew.
Ah, they would say that to me. I'm going to say, not the first one, sadly, but second as much as I can. Yeah, just stand in my way.
It was funny. I mean, I was reading on the train down here today to Brighton. I was reading Nick Cohen interviewing Ted Hundrick.
I love him.
In the New Statesman.
Nick Cohen, I presume, not Ted Hundrick.
No, Nick's a good friend of the programme.
I love him so much.
But
he got up and walked out, didn't he, of that interview?
He did.
Nick did.
At one point, Ted Hundrick says... Ted Hundrick is one of these classic...
So who is he?
Islamists. He's a philosopher, and his point is... He's Canadian.
Okay.
And he's one of these classic Islamist terrorists to blame on absolutely everybody but Islamist terrorists. Yeah.
It's the fault of the worst. That's what he said.
And he says to Nick at one point, I'm not like people like you, who through external pressures may have changed their opinions. One of those pressures, of course, being Jewish. Now, Nick countless times pointed out that he hasn't been Jewish or his family hasn't actually been in any way identified as Jewish for about 150 years.
I've always said to Nick, you don't need to identify yourself as Jewish, Nick, because there's always some bastard who'll do it for you.
There was that classic Nazi line, wasn't there? Well, who was it? It was the mayor of... remember.
Was it the one who said, I decide who is a Jew?
I decide who is a Jew. Exactly.
Well, I had to do that in the past, and once I decided I was, but they didn't call me out. Well, I always think when I hear a Jew going, I'm not a Jew, I think, well, I have yours. What can we swap identities? Because I'd be one any day. I'd put up with all the crap I got put up with just to be one. I've only got a bit of foreign blood, and that's Welsh. And that's the only one. It's 160, but man, do I up on about it, don't I? I took one about my friend, don't I? Really, I pretend it practically, you know. I'm like, what's his name? Lando Petrov, what was his name? I practically pretend I'm the next King of Wales or something. It's not true, but I don't see why I'd love him. I love your foreign blood. And I used to take these pills that turned my skin darker, but then I went orange. So expensive, Imodium, but they worked, didn't they, for a summer. But then I went orange, so I had to stop. So obviously not, I'm not racist. Sorry.
We were talking about this sort of, you know, the way you can sort of spot when the sort of anti-Semitism comes into an argument. And you wrote an article for The Guardian in July 2001 it sort of got onto Islam.
Yeah.
Although it was about, uh-huh. It was about this thing that the BBC was doing about an Islam week or something.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And
God's Guardian for us, Islam, that was great.
It was sort of quite inflammatory, but there was a massive response afterwards. Yeah, and I was reading a lot of the letters, and there's this thing that always comes up, which is, this was, you were writing about what you perceive to be problems of Islam. And right. This was before September 2001, so there was absolutely no mention whatsoever of Israel, or,
yeah.
I don't think, in the article at all. But then in the letters that you get in response,
yeah.
There's always this thing, you wouldn't say that about the Jews. You know, you wouldn't say that. Here's Julie Birch, you're writing these articles, yeah. She's saying terrible things about Islam. She wouldn't say that about Judaism.
She wouldn't say that about
Buddhism.
Because they're not in the habit of stoning rape victims to death and executing people for being gay. So no, I shouldn't say that.
It seems like this reflective thing where it's always picked up as the opposite. So you get an instance where there's the Denmark, Danish journalists print cartoons about Islam.
Oh yeah.
And that's a big scandal and whatever. That goes off, and so people in Iran say, we're going to do something back. Let's have a think about this. Should we do something about, I don't know, Vikings or something? No, yeah. let's write cartoons about the Holocaust.
It's always,
which is so irrelevant.
And no one made any kind of fuss
like
that.
Always the Jews to take the flak. right back to every atrocity that happens between Christians and Muslims. When the awful massacres during the Lebanon War a long time ago at the Sabra and Shatila camps, mm-hmm. I remember I was quite young then, but I remember thinking, hang on, it was Christians who massacred Muslims, and guess who got the blame? It was the Jew what done it. The Jew internationally is like the butler, you know, the butler did it and the Jews did it, whatever it is.
So do you think there's, Sarah, do you think there's an element of anti-Semitism in anti-Americanism?
Yeah, I definitely do. I definitely do. Because I think, you know, the anti-Americanism, you're obviously going to ally yourself with the people who fundamentally are anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. And I think that even if you're not aware of that, I think that is the position that you must take.
Well, the two things go together, don't they? Because obviously, you know, there's this, the idea on the left that Israel is basically America's proxy in the Middle East, or Israel is incredibly funded. This totally ignores the relationship that America has with Saudi Arabia, for instance, obviously.
Yeah.
But the two are always inextricably linked, aren't they? There's always this idea that America and Israel are somehow in bed together. So
sounds good to me. I've been meeting that so much. Sorry, man.
So, where was I? Do you think, well, Padraig's already asked the question, do you think these things are, Julie, do you think these things are linked? Anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism, do they always go together?
Yeah, very much so. I think people are, it's, as I said before, it's about, some people think they have an inherent right to rule other people, and I think the potentates of the Middle East and the left-wing public schoolboys in England both feel, although they can never admit this, well, the public school boys can, that they were born to somehow have joy de seigneur over other people in the world. And I think both the Jews and the Americans are seen as upstarts who were allowed to somehow jump over the counter and end up on the winning side, whereas they should have obviously toiled in the fucking sun until they died. And I think America and Israel are being seen somehow as being getting away with it, and ignoring the facts, how incredibly hard. What those countries have in common is that they drew a civilization from parched desert, and I think this makes them cleave together often. It'd be easier for America, as you said, it'd be easy for America if they didn't support Israel. It's not the easy option. They're not doing it for the oil. If America did not support Israel, they would have such an easy ride from the oil-rich nations.
I think there's this idea as well.
It's a beautiful thing. They've sacrificed themselves for Israel, and I love that.
And there's also this idea that it's absolutely unexamined, this relationship, and you automatically discount these people like Philip Roth, Norman Mailer, Thor Bello, these incredible thinkers who do engage with this question all the time.
The level of self-examination and self-rebuke of Jewish writers and Jewish political activists should bring a tear of humbleness to the life of everybody else. If there is only one iota of the self-examination on the part of Muslims in the world, as there is, I mean, I adore the Jewish people, but I'm a very aggressive person, and sometimes I feel frustrated by the amount of time they've got for everybody else, and they make excuses for other people. And if only the Jews had a bit more. When people say to me, when I say I love Israel, and people go to me, oh, you know, I like the Jews, the great writers of the past, like Kafka, but you don't mean like Israel, you mean like the Jews. And I've got this riff, and I go, no, I don't like the Jews, I like Israel. I no longer want to see a scared little man in a shekel, bent over a book with a candle. I want to see a Jew stand up and say, never again. And I don't want to see a little bent over learned man, because that's what they were and look where it got them.
Well, it's the classic argument of the new Jew, really, isn't it? It's something that you always come across as well. Anytime you defend Israel at all, you get this argument of, oh,
they've ruined
it. Their treatment of the Palestinians, and you think, the Jews of all people should have learned the lesson. And my response to that is always, yes, the Jews have learned the lesson. The Jews have learned the lesson.
Absolutely.
We are never going to let this happen to us ever
again. But their decency, that thing they do that was on the news yesterday, that whenever they're going to bomb some Islamist leader, they ring up and tell him, so they can all get out of the house. And now they start doing that human shield thing. But that is typical of what Islamist leaders do. That is the only time they have got any use for women and children.
But it's interesting that this time, you know, there was an incident a couple of weeks ago where the women went to the mosque and a couple of them were shot, and, you know, it was, of course, this was another example of the despicable behaviour of the rapacious Israel killing innocent people.
Well, they kill their own women as soon as look at them anyway, just like dating the wrong person.
Well, then this time they haven't done it. They've basically said, well, okay, there's people surrounding these people, let's back off and let's not attack them. And,
but they're too bloody nice for their own good. Bloody Jews, they should be a bit nastier. It does make me feel upset sometimes, because I love them so, and sometimes I get this really sad feeling. I think you're gonna do it again, aren't you? You're gonna be too gentle, you're gonna be too nice. I mean, look what old Sharon did. Who'd have thought the old bruiser would go and do what he did instead of being, let's have peace? And I thought I could depend on him to be a warmonger. I love the Jews, but I fear for their strict decency that will always make them back down and always make them think about other people's feelings, and I just wish they were more like my people, the rednecks.
Now, we say there's a streak of decency, man. Of course, there are serious problems in Israeli society. I mean, there's the classic example of the Pride March in Jerusalem a couple of weeks ago, which was one of the few points on which Jews, Christians and Muslims could unite.
Yeah, but on the other hand, fundamentalist Jews in Israel, I knew from my short time there and from my Israeli friends, are very much disliked. Mm-hmm. They don't have to fight the army. All my Israeli female friends just say, I shoot a lot of them. It's the only country in which fundamentalists aren't revered, but rather made fun of.
Yeah.
When I was on the plane going over to Israel, my friends and I were the only non-Jews there, and there was a couple of, what they called?
Hasidics
at the front. Mm. And there were these two girls, and this is an amazing story. There were these two teenage girls, very cute, sort of like gorgeous green girls in crop tops. And they kept going past the Hazard Dicks and sort of like going like that and bumping and grinding. And I said to Nigel, oh God, look, they're disrespecting those holy men. And I thought somebody put a stop to it. But the girls' parents, so I looked over and the girls' parents were nudging each other and they whispered to the girls and the girls went and did it again. And it's the only country because of the amazing enlightenment and amazing progressiveness of the Jewish people. That's the only place that you'd see them teasing their own holy men and their parents taking them on to do it. I mean, towards the end, I felt sorry for the poor Hasidim because everybody else was laughing at them. I mean, these girls were like mischievous lapdogs. And it was lovely, but I thought, oh, you should respect your holy men. But of course, it's great they don't.
But do you think that there's a danger in Israel of the increasingly Orthodox right-wing elements taking over what was founded as a secular state?
There's got to be tight, there's got to be room for all people, and Israel's the one place where you can vote for them or not vote for them. Yeah. But they can just come in and change the laws overnight. Somebody said very interesting what you said about where people try to have equivalents and say, yeah, but you did that. Somebody said the other day, when people try, one of the most silliest outsiders in modern times is when people go, yes, it's bad there's fundamentalists in the Middle East, but of course George Bush is a fundamentalist too. And I heard a man on the radio say, there's lots of differences, of course. The fact, well, Condoleezza Rice, you know, she's not walking around, you know, in a chador apologising for herself. But on the other hand, when George Bush leaves office, the laws on abortion and homosexuality, because of the system of checks and balances, will be completely unchanged. Yeah. And they'll be what they were when he went in. When Islam goes into a country, when it sweeps through Nigeria, through Sudan, it ruins and it spoils, and the thing, when it sweeps through, everything changes and stays changed. Mm-hmm. America, because it is a civilization with so many checks and balances, yeah, would never end up in that way. One man could not change things for the worse, I do believe.
And Bush, of course, has a finite time in power, and in the elections a couple of weeks ago, he's pretty much lost all of that anyway.
Absolutely, and it's so different to say that America is fundamentalist in the way that. Mm-hmm.
What really pissed me off recently was when Bush wrote that note to Condoleezza Rice, you know, I think I need a bathroom break, and everyone picked up on this as if this made him some kind of moron. And actually, I thought, what the hell is wrong with that? You know, he's in a meeting, he's written this note, it's actually polite. If you or I needed the loo and we were in some big thing, you're not just going to get up and walk out, are you? You know, that kind of thing, it's just kicking someone constantly. Yeah. Anything they do, it's just made rude or made stupid, mm-hmm, or made this or that.
It was actually, it was an amazingly, Americans are damned if they do, damned if they don't.
Exactly.
It was his first time in the UN, and we're told all the time, oh, you've got to respect people's traditions, everyone's got different things. He said in his note, what is the forum on this?
Yeah.
For all he knew, standing to go to the toilet when a Japanese was speaking, could have been like calling their mother, you know, a tart or something. Yeah. And I could see what he meant by that.
Okay.
And people willfully disregard and try to make him out to be so much more stupider than he is.
Yeah.
A stupid man doesn't promote Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell to the positions they're in. A stupid man don't do that.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to your point, there was a similar thing about that famous scene in Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, where Bush called on all nations to fight the terrorist threat, and it was on the golf course, and then said, now watch this drive. And this was made out to be the worst thing ever, proof that he's
so
stupid. But it plays into, I remember talking to a contributor to the magazine he's worked for last year, and he'd written a very good book called A Room About the Jews. It was Stephen Eric Bronner. And we were talking in pub later that evening after interviewing him. And what he pointed out was that anti-Semitism is a particular form of racism, in that they're both the cleverest people in the world and the stupidest people in the world.
Yeah.
They're both the most austere people in the world and the most vulgar people in the world. They're everything.
Yeah, they're sentimental purities.
Yeah, you can see a similar thing happening with Americans.
They throw their money around, but they're also very mean. Mm. They marry in and keep to themselves, yet they also reach out and influence everywhere.
Yeah. They're the Bolshevists and they're the capitalists.
Absolutely, yeah.
They're everything.
I often say, aren't they clever? What great people.
Well done then.
Wish I could do that, man.
It always strikes me as interesting that they can pull off something amazing like 9/11, you know, big conspiracy, and they pulled that off. But they can't pull off Iraq. They've messed that up completely. Yeah. How does that work? How does this conspiracy that runs the world can completely cover up something like 9/11, but they can't pull off
an
invasion?
And the bet with the remake of Gypsy was absolute rubbish.
I want to get back to a point you made earlier about, this may be a rather spurious link, but about Israel and America being countries and populations, a group of people more than a nation, maybe more than a state, rather more than a nation, who fought for their own corner and really built something. And there's an extent, certainly with America, where it is actually a working class nation.
I was going to say that.
And you mentioned that there's perhaps a thing on the British left which has a slight resentment of
who
working
are these
hayseeds?
I mean, the common thing about, you know, people? Even a thing like The Simpsons, it's a coverage you've done that, isn't it? But, they are perceived as literally, I mean, the thing about Bush is, people have stopped doing that thing now, oh, he's a rich boy, he inherited from his father. That was used up very quickly, and the prevailing thing has been, he's just a hick, and you know, they're all just hicks. I think it needs on, sometimes the same people who are critical of America are the same people who will use the word chaff.
So following up on Padraig's point there, do you think there's this idea that anti-Semitism, when the Jews were victims, they were a popular cause on the left, obviously. Do you think basically they've just got a bit above themselves, you know, they're
I think if you, another element of anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, whatever, is a deep snobbishness that even people who are not inherently bad have about the Jews. I love Agatha Christie. When you read some of her early books, it will actually say the swore of the Hebrew, the oily Levantine. And you think, Jesus, girl, why are you going about this all the time? It's also snobbishness. It's what you said, that, you know, it's the one place where both left and right can converge with a racist feeling and get along really well over it. Mm-hmm. When you look at someone like, and also this is why the anti-involvement in Iraq people are such strange people, like Cindy Sheehan, who's the mom who bothers Mr. Bush all the time, is always calling it the War of the Jews' War. I believe that the Ku Klux Klan man, is it David Duke?
David Duke.
He and his people are also against the war in Iraq, and they call it the Jews' War.
I see what you're saying about victims, though. It's easy for the left to be anti anyone who is possibly above them. So you always need to be on the side of someone who is.
Julie was saying that there's this class of British middle class leftists. Yeah, exactly. And while the Jews were, you know, the Holocaust obviously terrible event, blah blah blah. And you know, while the Jews were perhaps building Israel in the early 40s, they were a good solid cause for the left to support. As soon as they start, you know, showing a bit of spunk, they start throwing their weight around a little bit, you know, standing up for themselves, suddenly they become...
Yeah, exactly, doing their own thing. So it's not such an easy course to follow, so it's easier to follow...
When I hear left-wing people talk about the good old days when the Jews were, like, lovely, sweet people, it's as though they want the Jews to act as a nation, which is like the Meta Dolorosa, how do you pronounce it? Is that it?
Yeah.
As though all people should embody this idea of the grieving mother whose job is just to grieve and to suffer, that the Jews suddenly turned around and they did two things. They got blonde and they fought back.
They're no longer subservient. And
they also got, the girls got really fit. Because like Jewish men were always really fit. But suddenly, when you go to Israel, it's like, oh my gosh, what's going on? And I don't know, you go to Israel and people there are nobody of goodwill could go and look at those people of every hue. When I was there, I couldn't believe that. I've never seen, it was those people they took there from Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Every hue.
Falasha
Jews. People from India rubber black to the palest Nordic looking people in the world. And I'm sorry, you're not going to tell me that country is racist in any way whatsoever. Because it's the darker immigrants who will vote for the right-wing parties.
You see, you told me that, and I was surprised by that.
The European ones who are more liberal. Also, if you look at their football team, the most amazing thing happened during the World Cup, their football team is half Israeli-Arab. And I noticed this beautiful thing, which also made me feel a bit worried. The Israeli-Arabs sang the national anthem with great gusto. Mm. and the
there was also
the Jewish Israelis.
But people don't know.
But the African
on the point of information, Julie, Israel didn't qualify for the World Cup.
Well, but
there was a great moment. There was a great moment
Maccabee.
When a
Maccabee
Tel Aviv.
That was the one.
But there was a great moment during the World Cup when a Ghanaian player
who
played for Maccabi Tel Aviv scored a goal
it.
And pulled out and
he said that he toured his teammates for years that he was going to do that and he
how much trouble did he get in though for doing
that? I know it was like I hate this thing where people say to black people you should be on the side of Muslims. What Muslims do to black people in every country they come to, I mean, racial cleansing and that and stuff like that, is obscene. And what they did slavery-wise and everything, they were very, very racist people. There was a book written recently about Iraq by a left-wing commentator, and he said he was shocked to find when he spoke to the insurgents, a lot of them said that one of the things we particularly hate is that lots of these American soldiers are black.
Yeah.
Black men should not be.
This would be, certainly the Al-Zarqawi element is. It's very Arabist.
They hate black people.
Yeah.
And that some people on the left in England try and pretend that Islam is the black man's friend, it certainly is not.
Mm-hmm.
There's also this idea on the left that there's something organic about Islam and that it's the default setting of the third world. It's not. It's such a modern religion compared to Judaism. I mean, they just basically took their land, as everybody does, through violence and conquest. But there's this feeling that, they're naturally in touch with their, you know... I've read British feminists saying, but women have veiled, you know, they're in touch with their own womanliness. And
bullshit.
They don't have to get their tits out. No one has to get their tits out here. You could be a librarian and wear a maxi skirt. But you have got the choice. But there is a weird feeling now.
Because it seems... quite shocking that there seems to be a polarisation. You look at, I don't know, comment history on The Guardian, and there'll be, you know, somebody that, like, say for instance, we're talking about the veil debate that just gone on, which we're not going to talk about because I don't want to give it any more publicity, it was ridiculous. But there seems to be a polarisation which says, on this side you've got Muslim women wearing the veil, on this side you've got Western
black
slags
dancers,
who walk down the street naked. That's women in the West.
It's so insulting and wicked.
We, in the white Western commentators, always use the word hijab as shorthand for veil, for burqa, for chador, for various other things. And hijab is not actually a noun, it's an adjective, which applies equally to men and to women, even in the Quran. Hijab means modesty, that's all it means. And you may have been joking, but it is quite true that in Islamic society, it's only ever applied to women. It is demanded strictly in the Quran that all people dress modestly. You cover your forearms, you know, if you're a man, you cut your hair, if you're short and shakli and you have a neat beard. But that doesn't happen at all.
And it's so wrong because men are much more slutty than women. And ideally, it's they who should be, like, swaddled.
Yeah.
Just don't have any bad ways.
But I did...
It implies they simply can't control themselves.
Yeah, it's very insulting.
I did a radio show the other week.
It's very insulting to men, the idea that...
Yeah.
I saw the other day on Children in Need, and I'm not being nasty because it was good this little girl got help, but it was a little girl who couldn't get out of a chair. She had spina bifida, and she was only a child, and she was very handicapped. And she was wearing a covering. I'm not being funny, but even this small child, who at least should be allowed to feel the sun on her hair... She was covered up, and she was very badly injured, as though she was going to provoke people to lust.
Which,
I thought
again,
that was disgusting.
It's not demanded in the Quran at all.
It's so warped.
But it was funny. I did a radio show the other week, and it was the Moral Maze, actually.
I love the Moral Maze!
The woman on before me was...
Is it Claire Fox?
Full-on... Claire Fox wasn't on that evening.
Do you like her?
For another day.
Okay.
But the woman on before me was... full on niqab wearing Muslim, which is her right.
Was she one of those academics?
No, she'd written a book, she wasn't an academic, but she said she was fine, and I agreed with her to a point, and then she came out with this, what I thought was just a depressing line about, you have to understand that, women's beauty is the flame that men are drawn to. And men are the moths to women's flame.
It's
depressing for everybody. It's just a horribly depressing view of human beings.
Even though I'm a feminist, when I think now about the veil and stuff like that, I don't feel offended as a feminist, but I feel offended on behalf of men. I mean, all the people I've loved most of my life have been men. They're not freaking rapists who didn't see ankle and
jumpsuit. Like my immediate...
Oh, ankles,
my immediate reaction.
Keep your ankles.
My immediate reaction
to
someone like sharing a pretty face is that he's on
a
tits.
Tits
on my ankles, keep them covered up.
Can I just say something about these mums? These fucking mums come in and absolutely decry everything that their sons are doing. The week before I got fired from the Daily Mail, there was a story. You know, they always do these like five women who've lost 20 stone, yeah. Five women who've done this. It was five mums whose sons are in Iraq and they're absolutely anti it. And I read this piece and I never once cried in that office and I had to go and sit in the loo and I just absolutely gutted. And I thought, how disrespectful of your son's choices. It absolutely makes him out to be a moron, you know, mm-hmm. Like he's chosen to fight for this, you know, whatever the army wants. Exactly. And for you to stand up there and say it's wrong and it's this and it's that is the most disrespectful.
So she was saying that it was wrong, that he was...
Yeah, and he's like Tony Blair, as if he's incapable of making his own choice.
She's saying that the army should be allowed to vote. He's made a choice. What wars they fight, and that means that you live in a military junta.
Exactly.
And B, she's saying that her son, actually though he seemed to be able-bodied, you know, intelligent young man, was actually a fool who was duped into going to do a thing he didn't want. But for every parent like that, I did read the other day this man whose son had been an architect, and it is... cheerful when middle-class boys choose to go into the army.
Yeah.
And this man's son had been an architect, and his dad said, but, you know, he's never really happy. He just thought he was wasting his life. And then he said to me, Dad, sit down. I'm going to join the army and go to Iraq.
And he found a cause.
And his dad said, even though in our family we've always been anti-war, he said, I know when he died he's unhappy because he was doing something that he wanted to do and he was helping other people. And that should be the attitude if your son dies in the war, not, oh, my boy, he was an idiot. He didn't know what he was doing. That's so awful.
So we just mentioned a moment ago this sort of continuum from the sort of hijab wearing woman on the right to the naked slut. Why, Julie? Why are white working class people the only people that it's acceptable to have a go at these days?
Because I think there's an element in a great many people that likes to make themselves feel better by looking down on other people. Because of the Race Relations Act, which I think is... in many ways commendable. I do believe that certain things should not be allowed to be said. Do I? I'm not sure. But anyway, the thing is that if you insult any other group apart from the white working class, you will feel the long arm of the CRE on your shoulder. But you can say anything about chavs, that they breathe like rabbits, they have no sexual morals, that they're the people that ruin things for everybody else, and nobody... they literally are the last unprotected species. You can say what you like about them. It's a character.
It's seen as a laugh, isn't it? It's a big bloody joke.
And then when you go, don't say that, they will say, it's just a joke. What can I say about other people then? But you bloody don't do that.
And we did have that interesting case in Scotland a few weeks ago where, contrary to, thankfully, contrary to BNP propaganda, five Asian men were convicted for for a racist murder of a white young man. And... equally, and more so commendably, the mother of the murdered youth did say, this should not be a rallying point for the BNP.
What good woman.
That was the last thing it should be.
Shame we're not all like that.
But do you think, there may be an element where, we saw in the last local elections, BNP tragically did make gains in certain areas. And do you think unconsciously maybe that the liberal middle class who, on the news quiz or whatever else will
quite
cheerfully make jokes about Charles are contributing to the
definitely.
To what may be a siege mentality within the white
definitely.
Working class.
Definitely, for sure. My more sinister question would be, in a way, do they like doing this? Do they really like making this sort of trouble between the races in the working class that they will be in the future? And is it unconsciously, even amongst people who think they're good liberals, is there an unconscious desire to divide the working class along a colour line that will make sure their class is always secure? Maybe I'm just being paranoid. Go on.
It sounds to me like
maybe they are just
bordering
ignorant
on conspiracy theory, but
yeah, and I would hate to do that.
But I think perhaps maybe there is. I mean, you may be right in that, in an uncomprehending way.
Yeah.
It does happen, yeah. In that they don't really understand.
They don't understand the trouble that they're causing.
That,
that's mounting
you
up.
Know, because these are people who live in, you know, what are, you know,
yeah,
white neighbourhoods.
Nick Cohen said recently that it was just a matter of time now before particularly Eastern European immigration started to get to the middle classes, and they've been so happy now to exploit cheap labour, yeah, and say about the indigenous working class, oh, a bunch of chavs, oh, they're all racist, oh, they're spoiling it, we could be a rainbow nation. Of course, the poles as white as you know, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whiter than you. But the thing is, certainly when they do start over the next few years infringing on middle-class professions, mm-hmm, I think you will find, you know, the middle class then squealing and carrying on.
I find that already. I mean, if you look at a country like Ireland, where I'm from, which has a very different immigration experience, where the first major wave of immigration has been from Eastern Europe.
The Catholic thing, eh?
A huge amount of poles coming in. But there is, I mean, any time I go home for a holiday, you know, you kind of come across lots of poles out graffiti.
I would say that I've found out, a lot of my friends that I did have on The Guardian, even after I left, like Zoe Williams, a lot of my friends I fall out with because I've got this line, and my line is, stop white immigration now. And the reason why my friends always hated this is because I always said that I was totally in favour of non-white immigration, because I said those people, A, either we owe them something because the empire,
mm-hmm,
or B, they's in real trouble because their country is poor. But I always then said, but if we have Poles and people come over, it's going to be our non-white citizens who suffer, and this has turned out to be true,
yeah,
we get pushed out of the thing. And the more I said it to my Guardian friends, stop white immigration now, the more I could see I was getting them angry, because on one hand I was saying stop immigration, so that was right wing, but then I said stop whites coming in, and that was like a level of things to say. And the more I could see they was getting, their minds was going like fizzing, so the more I kept saying it. But I was been saying this for 5 years now, but we are now seeing totally that, you know, I can understand why the Polish want to come here, but it is making things worse for people on the lower rung of our society, our own immigrants, blacks and Asians, who have not had the chance to climb, and they're once again being squashed down by other white people. And I don't see how that is a good thing.
You've written in the past, if you don't mind me saying so, quite virulent arguments against
capitalism.
No, against Irish immigration.
No.
Against celebrations of Irishness.
I would say it's against capitalism. I've been twice taken to the CRE by a mad priest in Kentish Town.
I think I know that mad priest in Kentish Town.
Yeah, well, he's a very bad man, and both times it's failed, but I'm quite timid, and both times... When the Guardian rang me up, and both times it was Imagine Editor, and he said, I got bad news, and he said, you've been taken to a CRE by Father Jerry, what's his face? I don't know, but anyway, he's not very nice. Tuxedo Jerry, my friend calls him, because he's got all these nuns dancing attendance on him. Anyway, so it was he both times. What I said was, I'm sort of looking at you slyly now, the Irish people was far too good and noble to have been oppressed by a religion like Catholicism. I'm saying that to the judge. I was never, ever anti-Irish, but I am very... I'm extreme Protestant, and I think Catholicism is a very, very bad religion. I'm sorry. It was anti-religious. It wasn't racial, because the Irish are whiter than I.
I do remember you writing a piece for The Guardian, which...
I don't like that stuff about St. Patrick's Day.
Yes,
it gets me down, because I'll tell you why. There's always a man who's drunk, and he's got a big rubber hammer, and you always get on the train with him, and you think he's going to hit you on the head. And I think also, you know, if I was Irish, I'd be pissed off that it would come into a freaking shamrock. You know, if I came down to a thistle, I'd be cross.
I don't mind. Well, I've got absolutely nothing against it.
I don't like the way that everybody
celebrates. You know, why the hell not?
Because
it's fun.
Because it helps the Pope get away with things.
You see, that's
conflating, you know, St. Patrick's Day.
Why should there be a St. Patrick's Day?
There's Australia Day. Everyone gets in those walkabouts.
Yeah, but we don't go on it. Yeah, but we don't go.
Well, actually, I sometimes do.
I think it's one of those things like gay St. Patrick's Day marches, when to be homosexual in Ireland, it's not a nice thing.
Yeah, no one has actually ever.
And
been,
the Pope says
no one in Ireland has ever been stopped. No gay people in Ireland have ever been stopped from taking part in the St. Patrick's Day march.
No, but the Pope says they'll go to hell and that they're subhuman.
But. The Pope isn't the Taoiseach.
I did not write about Irish people being bad. On the contrary, I totally admire Ian Paisley. But, what? He's one of my heroes.
He'd love to be described as Irish in here.
He's bloody lovely. Did you remember what he said to the Pope? Antichrist.
I find this interesting when you've...
He is the Antichrist.
If what?
The Pope. He's a wicked man.
If you want to
be. He was a Nazi youth man. You've got a case for him now. Well, you're crossing the floor.
He was in the Hitlerjugend for about...
He's going to be like, yeah, depends on Nazi.
For about 3 months.
Oh, that's all right, then.
Made to.
Oh, then you found out he didn't like it.
But... If you're going to endorse Paisley, then,
I just don't
then
like
you have to, you have to stop
what was that thing? What was that thing the Pope said recently about Muslims? It was that weird position of being, having to choose between the Catholics and the Muslims and totally going.
They're always saying that we're going to go to hell. We don't say they're going to go to hell.
Well, who cares? Julia, we know we're not.
Well, I care. You don't care about it. I do.
Julia, the idea of Catholicism is essentially corrupt. I don't entirely disagree with by any means. But you've identified yourself as Protestant.
Totally.
As if somehow that is a morally superior position.
It's the reason that I love. But it's faith, logical, is it?
What strain of Protestant are we talking about?
To me, the Reformation, all the things that... The reason why the four of us are sitting here and we're talking in a certain way and we feel excluded and we feel in a way on the outside of the way that things... We didn't think we'd be in this position 10 years ago. We're now holding a certain position, we're enlightened, but we're also believers in you have to do certain things at certain times. To me, the Reformation and the difference between being a Catholic and being a Protestant was to me the most important thing that ever happened in the history of the world. The idea that to be a Protestant is about how you behave, but the idea of being a Catholic is about how many times you go to church. And if you went to church, you could behave how you liked in your private life, whereas to be a Protestant is to have to actually live what you believe.
Yeah, so you would draw...
And you cannot be forgiven. You cannot go to confession. And do you know that, of course you know, in the Catholic religion, the same amount of Hail Marys you have to say for masturbation are the same as if you committed a rape. It's true. Well, how's that right?
You're creating your own brand of Protestantism here, which is...
I was a Lutheran. Now, Lutheranism was formed by a man who was in many ways very wicked and bad. But look what's happened. Mm-hmm. The Lutheran countries now of Scandinavia, I'm lucky enough to know a few Lutheran girls, and they're all really hot. I would say that during the terrible time, during the Second World War, the Lutheran countries had an amazing war record on helping their Jews. In fact, when you go to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Israel, there's a thing called the Hall of the Righteous Gentiles, and the first tree... There's only one country which has a tree planted its name, and the first tree just says Denmark.
Mm. Well, that's Holland, though. Holland's got the worst record.
Yeah, I know, but it's not the same.
that's where the thing of Protestant can make
I'm not logical.
Because you can identify yourself as a Lutheran, but even that has so many strands.
It's not logical. I'm on a journey of faith. My line is, I'm hoping to find out. I don't know what the answer is, but that's why when I've got all my work done, I want to go to theology school and be a theology student. Mm. It's the only thing I really want to do now.
Well, this is something we should probably talk about on another show. We're very quickly running out of time.
Yeah, I would not like to talk about my faith.
We will talk about it on another show.
Another show. So I'd like to say thank you very much to Sarah and Julie for being on Little Atoms.
Thank you very much. I've had a very good time.
We've all had a very good time.
Thank you.
And we will continue this debate another time.
Might as well talk.
Thank you.
Bye.